God's action, feel free to time.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As you can see, if you didn't know, I am not Governor Hogan. Governor has a cold this morning. Actually, he had it yesterday, and so he decided to take as the Secretary said, a wellness day to get better. So it's good that he decided to do that. So it's going to be the substitute teacher today. So as we get started, just wanted to make a couple of comments that the governor was going to mention, that the governor and the full administration supports HB 316, which is the video live streaming of General Assembly meetings. We think it's important that the citizens are able to and deserve to see how their elected officials are conducting business. As here in the Board of Public Works, this meeting is live streamed. It is recorded. We oversee billions of dollars in contracts annually. The agendas are posted 2 weeks before the meetings. Boards conducted in a public setting. And as I mentioned, those videos are also archived for those to see later if they didn't get a chance. And we think that should apply also to the legislature as well. Maryland is one of only 7 states that does not record voting sessions. And we think that the legislation that's being proposed by Delegates Moon and Salega are something that should be supported, and the current technology would allow for this transparency. Board of Public Works meetings are live streamed at a cost of about $4,000, so it's not a very expensive proposition. And currently, what is considered transparency are these types of boxes that sit in a couple of our offices. I think this is a little older than the ones before. Green for House, red for Senate. But we think that it's important that we, in the interest of transparency, that we go forward and move in this direction. So thank you. With that said, Madam Treasurer.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I know that you will give our regards to the governor. No one likes to have a cold, especially when it's rainy and gray out. I must say, a personal note, I just noted to Ms. Brogan, I believe that the comptroller, when he was a member of the House of Delegates, and I, when I was a member of the House of Delegates, some years ago, maybe a couple decades ago, actually sponsored a proposal for live coverage of the House and the committee. The committees are all covered now, but they weren't at that time. And I think it's really a boon to democracy. People understand then that issues are taken seriously when they actually see what is happening, and they see how people, how people really on both sides of the aisle discuss legislation seriously, and they begin to realize that some things that look simple are not always so simple. It's a very good thing. I think it's a great step forward.
Of course, the response was, Francho, you never shut up if you're
right. Right, there was that.
Well, that's...
Thank you. I just wanted to take a moment and remark that during our last Board of Public Works meeting 2 weeks ago, an unspeakable tragedy occurred in Harford County. It served as yet another painful reminder of the sacrifices that our law enforcement officers make every day. Last week, I had the privilege of joining hundreds of Marylanders in paying my respects at the funeral services for 2 of Harford County's finest, Senior Deputy Sheriff Pat Daly and Deputy Sheriff Mark Logsdon. Like everyone who attended those services and lined up along the motorcade routes, my heart was filled with emotions as we honored the amazing lives, and exemplary service of those 2 heroes. The touching tributes from Deputy Daly's sons, Brian and Taylor, you had to be there to hear these kids. Offered us a glimpse of the incredible life that their father lived and the influence that he had on his sons, both of whom are following in his footsteps and serving their community. And as I watched, as Deputy Loxton's son, who served as a pallbearer carrying his father's flag-draped casket, I couldn't help but imagine what must have been going through his mind. I know their fathers would have been proud of the courage and poise they displayed in a time of overwhelming sadness and grief. As their families and communities begin the process of healing, my wife, Annie, and I will continue to keep their families in our thoughts and prayers. And Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, I was very pleased to see Governor Hogan make such personal comments. It was entirely appropriate. And, boy, seeing those law enforcement officers at the funeral on Saturday was about as moving an expression of support from our state as I could possibly imagine. So please thank him for me.
I will.
For his comments and participation. Thank you.
Well, I know he was quite moved by the whole ceremonies, and of course we were all affected by the tragedy that occurred.
Well, and I must say a moment to recognize all those people who do put their lives on the line for us and understand that something quite unexpected, untoward, right, just can happen like that. But those, all those men and women throughout the state who every day risk not only themselves but their families, as,
right,
as Peter pointed out. We should keep them in our prayers very often, all the time, and hopefully not just at moments of great tragedy.
Right. Now, you have to remember that they are there to protect us. They step into the breach,
yeah,
when others are fleeing, yeah, and they do it willingly. So thank you. Okay. Madam Secretary.
Good morning. Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, Madam the Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, we have 17 items on the Secretary's agenda. There's one report of an emergency procurement. We are withdrawing item 12 and are prepared to respond to any questions you may have.
Any questions?
Want to thank whoever pulled item number 12, okay, because...
the Housing Department, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question. Number six,
the wetlands license. You have your wetlands administrator, Mr. Bill Morganti, who has reviewed the recommendation from the Department of the Environment in favor of the license. Mr. Morganti concurs with the recommendation in favor of the license for the Maryland Port Administration. In addition, though, we do have an adjacent property owner who would like to be heard on exceptions. Mr. Morganti.
Good morning. Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Bill Morganti, Wetlands Administrator for the Board. I'm here to provide background for the wetland license for the Paul Sarbanes Ecosystem Restoration Project at Poplar Island. What's before you today is the licensing for Phase 3 of this project. So Poplar Island is 16 miles south of the Bay Bridge in Talbot County, just northwest of Tillman Island. In 1847, Poplar Island was 1,140 acres, but by 1990, Poplar Island had been reduced to just 5 acres, mainly due to sea level rise and erosion. Federal and state agencies collaborated on a plan, however, to use clean Chesapeake Bay dredge materials to restore Poplar Island to its 1847 size. So after scientific study, examination of alternative locations, and the permitting process, the port constructed and now operates phases 1 and 2 of the Poplar Island project. So this project is seen as a unique in economic and environmental success because Poplar Island provides a repository for millions of cubic yards of clean dredge materials from the Baltimore Harbor channels, and it enables Baltimore Harbor to kind of continue as a successful port. As well, it provides ecological habitat. It provides wetlands, uplands, and open embayment areas. So the port at this time seeks license to, number one, mechanically dredge 5.6 million cubic yards of clean dredge materials from the Phase 3 footprint. So actually, the map you see before you is Poplar Island is to the center of the project. Phases 1 and 2 has already been built. The yellow outlined area is a proposed Phase 3. So the port's seeking licensing for this 5.6 million cubic yards, which will be dredged in this footprint of Phase 3, in this footprint of the yellow outlined area, and an access channel to Poplar Island. It seeks to license to transport these materials to specific areas of Poplar Island, to provide periodic maintenance dredging, to construct the breakwaters, containment dikes, spillways, breach features, and bulkhead to make Phase 3 happen, to create a total of 259 acres of upland habitat, 206 acres of tidal wetland habitat, and 110 acres of open water embayment. And this is all for 30 years. So there were two public information hearings held in July of 2015. And after distributing the MDE's report and recommendation to interested parties, I received a letter in favor of the project from Chesapeake Bay Foundation and a letter against the project from Mr. Zielinski, one of the owners of Jefferson Island, the small island that is nearest to Poplar, just east of Poplar. So after careful review of the project, consultation with MDE and DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Maryland Port Administration, an acoustics engineer, and speaking with the owner of Coach's Island nearby, and meeting actually with Mr. Zielinski, I recommend granting the license. Concerns remain about the impact of the expansion project, particularly the permanent loss of view on nearby property owners. And I believe Maryland Port Administration and the representative for the owner of Jefferson Island is here to speak as well, if you'd like to hear from them.
Okay. I have a quick question. Well, two questions. One, what is clean dredge material?
Clean dredge has been deemed the word clean because it's been harvested or dredged outside of Baltimore Harbor. There is this line within Baltimore Harbor that actually the report kind of showed that they're deeming the dredge materials inside this line and inside Baltimore Harbor is contaminated based on testing. And then materials outside that boundary and surrounding Poplar are deemed and they've been tested to be clean materials. So I guess they're freer from toxins. They're freer from any contaminants that could be harmful to anything that will be established in terms of the ecological ecological restoration.
Is that growth or whatever is natural erosion that caused it to... Now, I don't know what the channel originally was in 1847, but is it growth material, just organic material that's there that's going to be pulled out versus, I guess, in the inner harbor you have the metals from the old factories and the like?
So, I mean, the dredge materials that would be deemed as clean would come from channels that have silted in would have been caused by erosion or caused by silting. I mean, I guess a number of different factors that would have caused the channels to be not deep enough to actually successfully access Baltimore, the harbor.
Okay. So the second question is you're going to remove the clean dredge and place it in a location to try to bring Poplar Island back to close to the level that it was in the 1800s. What type of growth do you actually get there? In your wetland, it'll be a new wetlands, I guess.
So I guess just to clarify, so phases one and two that you can mostly see are mostly built would be those two phases would have been restoring Poplar to its 1847 footprint of 1,140 acres. So the proposal before you today for phase three is actually an extension, a larger area than the 1847 footprint.
It's analogous to an earlier footprint?
I don't know that the records show that.
Natural footprints went up and down, didn't they?
I don't know that they were actually before 1847. I think the 1840s, from what I've learned, was a time when actually there was more accurate mapping that was done for islands. So I think that the time period before that, there actually isn't accurate records for.
But you wouldn't say for time ad infinitum before 1847.
It was that size?
It was one constant size. That would be really quite unique.
I would agree. I mean, perhaps, you know, historically Jefferson Island and Cochise Island nearby was all part of one large landmass.
Okay. Thank you. Do we want to hear from...
Mr. Bougain, because you're... So you went through this process of hearing, you mentioned, and as I understand, actually, there was a condition regarding testing of contaminants that are put on this permit?
Yes.
Is that...
Yes. I mean, there's actually... there'd be a number of conditions that are relating to verifying, in terms of the regularity of the testing, and in terms of the levels of materials that go in there, that so that there's regular testing done to assure that materials that are going in there are not contaminated or not toxic, would not be anything that wouldn't allow kind of a successful ecological restoration to occur.
Didn't you recommend actually a change to strengthen MDE's recommendation on this specific condition, that your recommendation was to adopt the license that they proposed but strengthen this one condition about testing of sediment?
Yes. There was one condition M where I made a recommendation, I think, to clarify that the dredging, that for every new site that was going to be a clean dredge material site, it was really just meant to clarify that there would be testing done at each new site.
Okay. I guess we should hear from Mr. Zielinski.
Mr. Zielinski, or is it attorney?
Well, I think we'll both come up.
Okay, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Come up. We're glad to have you here. Just go up to the podium and judge yourself and
good morning. My name is Tim Henderson, and I represent Jefferson Island LLC, and Paul Zielinski is a member of that LLC, and he's also the owner of Lowe's Wharf Marina, which is directly across from the island. So you can see one of the things that he's been commenting on is that the view from Lowe's Wharf Marina will also be impacted by this expansion. I want to keep this very short. I know there's a lot of people here. I wanted to focus on just a few specific things that Mr. Zielinski has brought up over the last few months in the different hearings. One is that they bought the island in 2001. In 2001, there was no talk of this third phase. So they had no idea that it was in the works. In fact, I'm not sure the Corps or the Port Administration knew that it was in the works. Second thing is that the footprint, as was being discussed, of the 1847 footprint did not extend. And even if you go back to the 1600s, it didn't extend to this 500 and some odd acres that the third phase is going to cover. And so it's a form of island creation rather than island restoration. And I'm talking about phase three. Phase one and two, Mr. Zielinski and his partners were aware that it was going to be built. It hadn't really started, right, when you first bought it. It was starting, but it wasn't anything like it is today. There's some specific deficiencies in the application that I want to highlight. One of the obligations of the board and the Wetlands Administrator and the Maryland Department of Environment in putting together the response and recommendations is to do a avoidance analysis, an alternatives analysis, and to provide mitigation. The alternatives analysis is very deficient. As far as I can tell, there was not a full and robust examination of other island areas that could be restored as opposed to this island creation. As a matter of law, Maryland law, and in the environmental article, Title V, Subtitle 11, it does not authorize the board to authorize island creation. So a big chunk of this 500 acres would be island creation that we would argue the board doesn't have the authority to authorize. And that would have been part of a good, robust alternatives analysis to identify that. The one thing that's very, I'm jumping ahead of my talk, but one of the things that's very of great concern to Mr. Zielinski and his partners is that when they bought the island in 2001, they were focused on its attributes for hunting, fishing, bird watching, and those attributes and what they bought the island for are going to be severely impacted. And the Wetlands Administrator's reporting the Maryland Department of Environment report and recommendations acknowledges that and acknowledges it in 3 points. Noise, there's going to be significant noise for 30 years. And those noise levels for 12 hours a day are going to be equivalent of what industrial properties are held to in excess at times. There's going to be contamination. Even though contamination is being measured, there is one thing about the record for the application is they don't get into the levels that have been measured for phase one, phase two in any real depth. So what they do evaluate is water quality at the edge of the phase one, phase two Poplar Island and extending towards Jefferson Island, and they have found exceedances of water quality standards. So the plan is to sample the dredge material before it's excavated. And there will be excavations at the mouth of the Patapsco River, which, you know, it's just a line that's drawn. The mouth of the Patapsco River can be as contaminated as further in, up towards Baltimore Harbor. The other thing is the Corps of Engineers just samples the what's on the island every 3 years. And there's no condition proposed to increase the frequency of that sampling. I said I'd be short, so let me sort of cut to the chase. The view shed issue may seem esoteric, but right now, Jefferson Island, if you look at it, it has what's called a 50% over 60% of the island you can see out to the water. This is going to cut off 50% of that, this extension. And it'll cut off 100% of the view that's, it's called a 4 mile view, the long view up to the north. That's 100% of that's going to be blocked off. The report and recommendation of MDE and the Wetlands Administrator's report both acknowledge that these impacts, unavoidable impacts, will occur, but there's no compensation being offered. There's no mitigation that's being offered. It's just saying the public benefits, Mr. Zielinski and his partners won't. They'll suffer. But it's to the public good. So there's this fundamental question of what is the appropriate mitigation and or compensation. And I don't know if Mr. Zielinski has anything to add, or if you have any questions from him, since he's lived this. I'm a lawyer. I happen to have helped him and his partner out in 2005, but I really haven't been involved since last month. So if you really want to hear some of specifics of his issues, you could ask him and you could offer, if you have time.
We have a moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the main thing is the view. I mean, we have this property approximately about 600 to 700 feet up the front. They want to build.
You need to step to the microphone.
Yeah.
Yes,
I'm
it's
sorry.
Better. Because all this is being sorry. Recorded.
Hi. My name is Paul Zielinski. I'm the owner of Jefferson Island. And my biggest concern is approximately 600 to 700 feet right out in front of my property, this new proposed expansion, they want to put a 30-foot high wall in front of my island, 600 feet, not counting the trees or whatever they're going to plant on top. Then it's going to extend a half mile towards the east. There's going to be a big, huge wall in front of my property, blocking the whole Eastern Bay view from there. It's approximately about a 4 mile open view that's unobstructed. And then it's going to be behind my property of the dump site for the dredge spoils with the noise. And we purchased the property. The Poplar Island project was supposed to stop in August of 2026. Now, this is going to go on for, I think they say, like 2045. So I'm going to have to be out there dealing with this I lived that long, for 20 years of noise and all the construction work that's going on. Basically, I mean, just to keep it short, that is really my main objective to this construction site.
Thank you. In closing, I wanted to mention one other area that the application is woefully deficient. And neither Mr. Zielinski and I mentioned it, but the erosion, the erosive effect of both Phase 1, Phase 2, and this new extension. The data that's in the application is 13 years old. It was done in 2002, and it was based on an analysis of a configuration that is different than this new configuration. New being, you know, in the last few years. So there's been no analysis. There's no scientific evidence of the erosion that has occurred because of Phase 1, Phase 2. There's statements. There's just what I call unfounded, unsupported by science statements that by having Phase 1, Phase 2 there, Jefferson Island has eroded less than it would have. That's just a statement. There's no analysis that that's true. In fact, it appears that the erosion has occurred more. There's been more erosion in the last 20 years than there was in the last 150 years. And with that, I just want to mention that we would ask the board to return the application, to have it the Port Administration and the Maryland Department of Environment and the Wetlands Administrator evaluate, come up with the detailed, specific scientific analysis that's required for alternatives analysis, avoidance and mitigation, and also erosion, and to examine the contamination issue in more detail. If the board proceeds and issues the license, we are prepared, both Jefferson Island LLC and the marina will appeal the issuance of the permit. And we'll also explore all legal avenues for compensation for what would become, we think, a regulatory taking and or inverse condemnation of their rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? No. Question, Senator.
We do have an opinion or a letter of analysis from the Attorney General.
We have advice from the Attorney
advice from the Attorney General.
He said that, and who also informed us that would not be able to be here today. But the answer to both questions is yes, that the board could issue this license.
But it does not constitute taking.
I believe that reading is what she's properly saying is that that's the board's issuance of this wetlands license needs to concentrate on the wetland, that the taking issue is a separate issue. I wish she was here to be able to explain. But yes, you do have a 4-page memo in your backup materials.
In our bag of tricks.
Yeah, that came
yesterday. I'm not to put records on. I think this is attorney-client communication that you all can decide about.
Yeah, well, that's just a lot of nonsense that this board is restricted.
It's not.
The wetlands criteria.
It's not. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying.
So I don't know what our lawyer is doing, suggesting that it is, and perhaps maybe we could get a new lawyer.
Well, he was elected for 4 years, but the question was whether it constituted a taking. I mean, that was my question, and what the. I understand that it's an aesthetic and perhaps financial issue for you.
Maybe the Board of Public Works, would you like me to comment for the record? The question she felt was posed to her was, may the Board of Public Works issue this title wetlands to the port for this expansion project where Mr. Henderson asserts that the board's issuance of a license may result in a compensable taking of Jefferson Island? The answer to the question is yes. The board's authority under the Wetlands Act, as construed by the Court of Appeals, does not include the adjudication of constitutional taking claims. Instead, the board must limit itself to the effect of the proposed project on title wetlands. So that's why I didn't hesitate to say that she did not find this to be a taking. I don't know that she analyzed it. I mean, the whole thing we can go through. But what she was saying in her advice was that that's not what's in front of the Board of Public Works.
I mean, since she's not here to discuss this, a brief comment is that it is true in Maryland, the case law has not found that the taking of view shed, I'll call it view shed, is compensable, but hasn't found it's not. Other states have been finding that it is, and it's an extension of riparian rights. So you got to a very unique situation. There's nothing like this that I could find. There's nothing the Board of Public Works has dealt with, nor, as far as I can tell, the Port Administration with this kind of configuration, where you have essentially the island being created is really being created around an island that's a remnant of the original Poplar Island. In the 1600s, Jefferson Island was smack dab in the middle of what was the island. So it's a very unique situation to have an island being, you know, by a restoration of an island to the 1847 configuration, and then this extension to what I think is a new area, significant part of the new 547 acres or whatever it is brand new. There's never been an island there. So it's island creation. So it's exactly the kind of situation where I think we could get Maryland courts to join what I view as a trend in the states. Now there's no lawyer to but that's the position we would take.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, but based on our Attorney General opinion, what we're here today is really look at the impact on the wetlands itself, and that's what the license is extended to, and the arguments that you're making are a separate issue that we are not really addressing in an approval or disapproval of the wetlands permit. Am I correct in that?
Correct.
Madam Secretary?
Yes. And I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, that's why I didn't even get into it with you.
Okay. So thank you. Any additional questions? Concerns? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Fine.
I was just asking if there are other questions on the Secretary's agenda. I don't think we need a separate vote.
No, not at all. I just
want to, if I could, recognize Mr. White, who's sitting here from the port, and thank you for that extraordinary economic engine which the state of Maryland owns and that you oversee, because it is unbelievably important to our citizens to have the economic activity that you represent at the port. Keep up the good work.
Yes.
Are we still doing okay?
Yes.
It's going great.
The governor just signed a 30-year contract with Wilanese Pullman, who is the largest railroad company.
Why don't you come to the...
Thank you. Yes, the port is doing exceptionally well. Governor Hogan was just down signing a contract with Wilanius Wilhelmsen for 30 years. And I think this board knows that the jobs that we create at the port are good-paying, family-supporting jobs. Upwards of 127,000 jobs in Maryland, which produces every year almost $3 billion in salary and wage to Marylanders, plus $310 million in taxes back to the state. You know, we had two huge wins this year with long-term contracts, and the other was, Lieutenant Governor, you were there for the Maersk.
Yeah.
That was big, and those ships just keep getting bigger and bigger, so we need places to put the dredge material. But certainly, we have to install a level of confidence in our customers when we're signing 30-year deals that we have 30-year placement sites to put our dredge materials so the harbors stay deep and safe.
Very good. And we're working on access as well. I know the Transportation Department is looking at the railroad tunnel
so that
we can move freight from the port and to the different markets. And so, keep up the good work. I had a wonderful visit there, I guess twice now. And then I sat offshore not too long ago, also on a very cold day on a Coast Guard vessel. But it was wonderful to see the activity going on at the port.
Thank you. We got the governor's message. We're open for business.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mr. White, can I just apropos of the last concern, I know a question was raised of whether you couldn't locate the dredge elsewhere on another part of Poplar Island. My recollection is that there, a study was done, and the sediment that's there now didn't support the weight of the dredge on the other end of the island.
I'd like to ask Chris Coriel, our director of harbor development, to come up and answer that.
A yes or no would be true.
You are correct.
Yes.
Thank you.
For the record, you are correct.
Governor, could I just point out the next item after 6 is 7, and a great example, I think, of the wetlands process and how the administrator and the department and the neighbors and the person who was seeking a license could all get together and work things out in the public's interest. I congratulate you all.
Very good. Very good. That's Queen Anne's Marina. I am looking. I do not have any additional questions. On
move approval.
A second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Secretary Belton.
Good morning, Secretary. Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Mark Belton, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have three items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
Can you tell me a little bit about item 3A, Maryland Environmental Trust?
Yes, sir. We have Ann Carlson here from the Maryland Environmental Trust who can provide background on that information.
Thank you. I'm Ann Carlson with the Maryland Environmental Trust, and I can answer any questions you have.
Could you tell me a little bit about the acquisition, the easement?
This is conservation easement on 678 acres in Queen Kent County, right outside of Galena. The purchase will protect this whole area from development. There will only be 7 houses allowed on the property. It's removing close to 40 development rights. A number of those development rights are waterfront. The program and the funding source is to protect the viewshed along the Chesapeake Country National Scenic Byway, and this property has more than 5,000 feet of frontage along that byway and is immediately across the byway from another protected property. And so we've got a wonderful viewshed of rolling agricultural fields and forest right outside of Galena, protected by this conservation easement and adjacent to another conservation easement.
And did you need to have Eastern Shore Land Conservancy? Is that for funding purposes that the two of you are the grantees?
The Eastern Shore Land Conservancy worked with this as a federal funding source, and it was earmarked, and it was earmarked specifically for the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy and the boards of commissioners of Cecil, Kent, and Queen Anne's County to use those funds, and they approached the Maryland Environmental Trust to co-hold those conservation easements with them. So it's a partnership at the local county level, the local private nonprofit conservation organization level, and us as the state agency.
So it was federal funding that went to the land conservancy, or did it go to the county?
It's going to flow through. The county will actually give the money directly to the landowner at closing, and then the federal money will be reimbursed to the counties. The program requires that the federal government, that the money be transferred to the landowner by a agency of a government. And in this case, it's the county.
It's the county. I guess I'm just trying to understand where the Land Conservancy comes in and why couldn't you just do it as Maryland Environmental Trust? Why the other cooks in the kitchen?
Well, I think we were approached by these local entities to be the state partner, and we want to support our counties and our local land conservation in the work that they're doing. So that, I mean, so we were kind of added as an extra cook.
Oh, so you were brought in.
So we were brought in because the money was earmarked by then Congressman Gilchrist to this particular area. This was his district at the time, to the county government and to the Eastern Shoreline Conservancy.
Well, it takes a while to get things done.
Oh, we have been working on these for a number of years. This is the sixth
Treasurer
conservation
easement. At that time.
Yeah. I think this MOU was signed in 2007. So this is the last conservation easement which will be purchased with this pot of money.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the DNR's agenda? Move. Have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor? I think we have it. Thank you, Secretary. Department of Budget and Management. Excuse me.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. I'm David Brinkley, the Secretary of Budget and Management. We have 8 items on the agenda. I have people here to address any questions you might have.
I have a short inquiry in terms of our advertising with the Baltimore Sun LLC out of Delaware. Is this required to publish? Because I know that, and I know it's up to a certain amount. Do we also advertise in an electronic media? A lot of young people don't. Most young people don't read newspapers anymore.
Yes. Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Jamie Tomaszewski, Chief of Procurement for the Department of Budget and Management. We started this sole source contract with the Baltimore Sun based on economies of scale. The agencies were going out and getting advertising, but small agencies were paying a lot more money than our larger agencies that advertise more often.
Mm-hmm.
With this contract, we actually have an optional feature to advertise with the CareerBuilder.com. It's one of their partner vendors, so we do get that electronic. We also, as a state, advertise online as well. And we have a smaller local with the MarylandJobNetwork.com that does online advertising as well. So this is just the opportunity to get same pricing throughout the state for any time that they do need to advertise with the Sun.
So it's a master contract with the Sun, and then they partner with the others? Is that what you're saying?
We have a separate contract with the local Maryland Job Network for online advertising, again, as an economies of scale to get same pricing throughout the state. And then Career Builder is an option through the Sun because it's one of their partners to do the online advertising.
All right. Yes. Okay. Thank you. I just saw that. It seemed like a lot of money. And
would you please let the Baltimore Sun editorial board know that I'm voting for this despite what they say about me?
But reluctantly.
That's fine.
Governor, could I ask a question about,
sure.
Since I saw the secretary come in, number 6, the Department of Public Safety and Correctional.
Secretary Moyer.
Mr. Secretary, you know how highly I think of you and your work and your staff, and was delighted when you came in and took on this job. But I am concerned. Item 6 is an item that is before us after with a very long life, but somehow unforeseen circumstances prevented the department from issuing a contract or signing a contract on time. There are also some items in the PARS report, which are reports to us of items that are the same syndrome. What is the... What are the problems that prevent a smooth and efficiently moving procurement in this office?
Madam Treasurer, thank you, and Board, Lieutenant Governor Rother, thank you, and Comptroller Francho. The business offices within this department are all over the Baltimore region. We just consolidated all of the procurement offices into one specific location. I brought Mike Stelmack, who is my human resources director, here today. We have been recruiting. We have gone We've gone through recruiting for a director. We have six other vacancies. We've conducted interviews. We cannot find the right people. We are going back out. We're still trying to replace these positions. As far as the business function on this one, there, the solicitation is out. The bids are supposed to be in by March the 10th. I will take full responsibility for this one, for not riding herd on this. But as we move forward to try and put the best team in place on our procurement staff, we will continue to try and monitor this. If you want to hear from my HR director or the Deputy Secretary of Administration, we're making headway on a lot of different issues, and this is one where it's just trying to find the right people. I mean, I've even called people I personally know that, you know, would you please apply for this position, because I know, you know, that they're talented, but they don't want to give up the positions they've had for years. So it is a challenge.
Let me just say, I know the Lieutenant Governor is chairing a commission. The Comptroller has been very interested in the procurement process for years, as have I. I think this is just the question of how we attract and retain good people, how
absolute
we have
training,
the technology in place to bring these on, the training. I use you as an example because I do think so highly of you, Secretary Moyers. I think there are some structural problems.
Yes. I mean, a lot of it, and exactly what he's talking about, is where we're going to be looking. Amongst others, but one of the key areas is the professionalizing our procurement staff, the career path, the training, the consistency, the compensation, and making sure that we can attract as well as retain, you know, the best possible. We do have the challenge of some of the counties pay extraordinary amounts of money. The federal government pays higher than we do, but we have to figure out ways to address that so that we can retain people as well as attract people, and then the folks that we have, making sure that they're trained to be able to do the job. We have some very good people here now. We just don't have enough that are trained and competent in those areas. And it's not because they don't try. It's because they haven't had the guidance and training in many cases.
I'd like to point out those examples, as you know, where the legislature and the executive branch are focused on the same problem. There was a hearing in the legislature last week about the procurement process. This is something, if we can get it together, I think you're going to find very strong support across the board.
Thank you for allowing me to use you.
I mean, you all know I'm a retired trooper, and I was at the viewings and the memorial services, and thank you all for your comments, and Comptroller, thank you for being there as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions?
I had item 3S, please.
Steve Port. Principal Deputy Director.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. We're being asked to approve a two-year, $1.3 million contract with a Michigan-based firm called Health Management Associates to assist with the second phase of the state's Medicare waiver application. Out of the three bidders for this contract, this firm, HMA, actually submitted the highest bid, 18% higher than the second highest vendor and 24% higher than the low bidder. However, the Health Services Cost Review Commission, HSCRC, believes that the winning bidder has such technical superiority that it outweighs the price disparities. So my first question is, what is it about HMA and its bid that makes this firm so technically superior to its two competitors?
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. So when the evaluation
Please identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Shirley Gerovich. I'm the director of the research and methodology at HSCRC, and I led the evaluation team for this procurement. After we looked at the financial proposals, the evaluation committee met again to address the question that the controller Francho asked. Is it worth to award the contract to the highest bidder, and is their technical proposal outweighs their price differences. When we looked at again for their technical proposal, this contract weighted the technical scoring higher, and when we evaluated all three bidders, HMA's contract outweighed all the others in all the areas. The contract is arranged for different scopes of tasks. So they have analytical scopes, they have stakeholder engagement, they have to write, and they also have to help us with the negotiations with the federal government. On all these areas, HMA ranked the first, and the others change between second and third. So that's kind of the strength that they had. In addition, they have a lot of experience in Maryland. They've been enrolled in care coordination activities that will be central for this application. Given their experience in Maryland, we think that the amount of time that they have to spend on this would be much smaller than the other contractors. So this is a time and time contract, so it will depend on how many hours that they need to perform the tasks. And overall, we think that the price differences might be remedied by their experience in Maryland, and they would not need as much hours to learn our system. And thirdly, their team is very experienced. Their lead is in experience in total cost of care, which HSCRC do not have that much experience. As you know, we are focused on hospital finance so far, so we really need that expertise. And this HMA contract team provided that expertise that we need. In addition, their auditors have experience with the Medicaid in the state, and their analytical team has experience with the HSCRC data sets and Medicare data sets that will be essential for the contract.
And Mr. Comptroller, Steve Ports with the HSCRC. HMA also helped us on the phase one negotiations with the federal government because they had done significant negotiations in the past with CMS and federal government, and that helped us in our negotiations on phase one. So they've been, they do have a lot of experience in Maryland and have been through this similar kind of arrangement in the past with the HSCRC.
Okay. So, according to my background materials, a gentleman named Dr. Patrick Redman is a subcontractor on HMA's bid. He also happens to be the former executive director of your organization, HSCRC. Could you give me a little more insight? How long did Dr. Redman serve as the executive director of your agency, and when did he leave his post?
He served for a year and 3 months. He left in April of 2013, and that was before the other contract was finished. The contract with the federal government on phase one was not signed until February 11th of 2014, and it wasn't even anticipated that there would be a phase two at that point in the process. We began to work on this procurement for the phase two in early 2015, so he would have been long gone by the time we would have begun this procurement process.
Okay, I just want to make sure Dr. Redman was not on either of the other bids, the two losing bids. He wasn't listed anywhere, what is not a subcontractor to them.
That's correct.
Okay, so my final question is, who was involved in the selection process, and did that individuals work for Dr. Redman when he was executive director? I recognize that that is a rather uncomfortable line of questioning, but I think you can appreciate the optic here. If in fact the people on the selection committee were involved professionally with Dr. Redman.
Right. It was the process was led by David Romans, who was with the commission, currently is not with the commission. He was not with the commission at the point when Dr. Redman was with the commission.
But who else was on the committee?
The others were, I'm the only one who worked for Dr. Redman when he was executive director. The other evaluators were Ben Stephan, the executive director of Maryland Healthcare Commission, Trisha Roddy from Medicaid, and Dr. Half from DHMA. Since this is a contract that is going to be department-wide, we composed a team that kind of got all the other members from the DHMA. So I'm the only one.
But those other folks, I take it, worked with Dr. Redman when he was the executive director.
Yes, but not for him. Except Dr. Haft. I think he wasn't in the department.
No, he wasn't. Well, I can see the value of
the previous experience. Was that part of the technical evaluation or not?
Not even the subcontractor.
I think the fact that the organization has worked for us on a very complicated, pretty unique arrangement that is the envy of every other state around the country. With this waiver that we have, I can see why experience was important, but I'm still a little concerned about the, as I said, the appearance of him being involved. And I'm not implying anything. I'm just talking about what it looks like from the outside.
And to just place his role in perspective, it's my understanding that on the analytical side, he's works for Berkeley Research Group. And as I recall, I think his hours were somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 hours overseeing the analytical team at BRG, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 hours. So his experience will help ensure that we're looking at the right data, that we're doing the correct analysis, and to get us to the end that the state needs to get to on the phase two contract.
If I could have this one pulled out, I'm reluctantly going to vote no.
Any concerns?
I have no concerns with it being voted on separately. I would like to have the opportunity to vote for it.
Mr. Secretary, you wish to speak?
If you don't mind, I'd like to just address what is the urgency of this. I think it's December of 2016. We have to have the report back into CMS. So in that context, I'd like to see it move forward if at all possible. I understand the optics that you're talking about, Mr. Comptroller. We've reviewed it and looked at it. As you just alluded, it's a very technical. We are the envy, but we are also under the gun in regards to the whole all-payer waiver system. I met with Ms. Kinzer yesterday in regards to our next phase. We have a meeting next week with them. So we're at a real tenuous point in regards to whether we're going to be able to keep this. We just had a financial analysis done that is a value of about $1.8 billion to the state and the 47 acute care hospitals. So, I understand. I definitely understand your optics.
And I assume, Van, that everybody will do everything they can to enhance transparency and make it quite clear what to the public and everyone what
absolutely.
The process is.
Absolutely. No question about it. No question.
Okay. Thank you. I think we can. we'll take a separate vote on this item. Motion.
On this one?
I'll move
for favorable.
A second. In favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. 2-1.
Thank you. And the balance of budget agenda.
Any other questions on the balance of this budget amendment?
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor? Okay. Except for 3S, which is 2-1.
We got it. Thank you.
Okay. University of Maryland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Representing the University System of Maryland. We have 6 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
Question 2AE, and actually I think it's a couple of A&E on-call contracts that are here, and I'm going to raise a similar question with State Highway when we get to Jim Forbes. The on-call contracts, it seems as though, let me just ask this question. Are any of these, and we'll start with 2AE, are any of these contractors small or minority contractors, A&E firms? I know Chauvin is, Whitman's not. Not familiar with the others.
Chauvin is.
They are. Okay. They're MBE.
They're MBE.
Okay.
what I'm looking at, I recognize Chobin. I can go back and look at the rest of them.
Okay.
And get back to you which ones are small and which ones are minority.
I just, you know, I know that in some cases, and particularly when we get to jumping ahead to the transportation agenda, there are some cases that it's very specialized and it's very difficult for some of the smaller A&E firms to do the work, but I just want to make sure that we're reaching out, we're not bundling these contracts so that no one can compete other than the largest, you know, firms, and so that's just the message I wanted to send out.
My campus does have a small AE contract. It's small business reserve. It's only AEs that's on it, and it's on call.
What's the value of those contracts?
I think it's capped at $200,000.
Okay. Well, just my this job, public service or a private experience, I represented at one point a number of A&E firms. Some of them were MBEs in this state, and they were working in Virginia on Virginia's mega projects. The mega projects, and again, it goes back to the state highway. But they were having a difficulty working in the state. Not necessarily with the University of Maryland, similar to what the treasurer was using, Secretary Moyer, I'm using you. But they were doing transportation projects in the millions of dollars, and on one occasion meeting with, and I guess I should be talking to Jim Ports here, a person in transportation, they said, well, these firms can't do million-dollar projects. And we were saying, they're doing $3 million projects now in Virginia, and you don't believe they can do it here in Maryland. And so I appreciate your, you know, having the small business reserve, but some of these firms out there can do larger projects than that. So just something to keep in mind.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any other questions for your agenda. Any questions?
Second.
All in favor?
Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. Getting warmed up for transportation. Information technology.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. I'm Luis Estrada, the Deputy Secretary, Department of Information Technology. Today we have four items on the agenda, and we are withdrawing items 2IT and 4IT. We have agency representatives here to answer any questions on the remaining two items.
Those were the two that I had questions on.
I know.
So just so you don't feel too comfortable, how about item 3? We're being asked to authorize a one-year contract extension with a California-based company, Security Mentor of Pacific Grove, California, to provide cybersecurity training for state employees. This is an extension of an existing contract, a 12-month extension. It will cost the state $202,548, which amounts to $16,879 per month. This is the second extension that we've been asked to approve. It looks as if the price of this firm's services has gone up substantially. The original contract that we awarded back in August of 2013 was a 16-month deal worth $107,700 or $6,731 per month. So in less than 3 years, we've seen a price escalation of 151%. And despite that, we continue to grant these extensions. And I guess the question is, why haven't we put the contract back into the marketplace for some actual bid competition?
Sure. One of the reasons for the increase is the addition of licenses, so our use has gone up. The price has also increased but remains below the price that we're able to obtain elsewhere. We do plan to compete the service in the coming year to fit in our larger cybersecurity strategy, which is currently developing. So we have been very pleased with the service. There is a high adoption rate, and these training lessons are addressing one of the primary security vulnerabilities in IT, and that is the employees that are entrusted with sensitive data. So being able to reach 45,000 state employees with these easy, short lessons that are delivered monthly is very important to us. So, again, the price analysis we completed does indicate that the current pricing is advantageous to us to leverage the contract that the state of Michigan acquired with Security Mentor, and the recompete of these services, again, will be done under our larger cybersecurity strategy.
So the justification for a cost hike of 151%, again, is what?
The addition of licenses represents...
what does that mean, addition of licenses?
So the original contract was for 30,000 licenses, and we've increased that to 45,000 licenses. And then the price increase is just an annual increase for that service, which still remains, the price remains below what we're able to obtain this service for outside of the state of Michigan contract.
Okay, and then my second complaint with this is that I believe the contract's going to expire on Monday. This coming Monday?
That is correct.
Well, why are you waiting until the last possible moment to request an extension?
Well, normally we try to put these on the BPW agenda a couple of meetings beforehand, but we were not able to with this one.
Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, I'd be grateful if we could hold this item for 2 weeks to the next meeting to examine the spiraling costs and get a clearer sense of what exactly is going on, because I appreciate all the leadership on procurement reform. I happen to think that we need to put our foot down from time to time. And, sorry, coming up and essentially saying you're in a corner and you have to vote for this, otherwise it expires. It's wrong.
I apologize. That certainly was not our intention.
What would be the impact of delaying this? The contract expires Monday. And
this training is an important pillar in our cybersecurity strategy, because the number one cause of breaches of cybersecurity is the employees that are actively using state entrusted data. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to keep this service going and providing that training for each of the 45,000 state employees.
Governor, Comptroller, I must say I agree with you about the dates. It burns the heck of me out of when I see this happen. But on the other hand, I don't want to lag in security training either. Is that what you are saying, in fact, would happen?
Yes, the security training would lag until we're able to get a contract in place.
And you are a control agency over a number of different agencies in terms of IT and cybersecurity, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us that we won't see this sort of situation again?
Yes, we strive to deliver these to the board several meetings beforehand. Our apologies for the late submission of this item.
What really happened? I mean, no one's listening. You can. No one's watching at home. But.
So our cybersecurity strategy is evolving, and this is one piece of it, and it was determined a little bit late in the life cycle to proceed in this way rather than recompeting the service. That will also give us time to really examine what the how this fits into our overall strategy as it evolves over the coming year and complete the competitive procurement.
Governor, as I understand it also, this is ongoing training. This is not something that, you know, you do once a year and so you could do a month later. And is that right?
That's correct. It's a monthly subscription.
It could be helpful if it had been, if there had been a little more explanation here of that fact. It would make my support of this item more comfortable. Thank you.
I think we'll have a separate vote on this item. And so I'll move for a vote on this one item.
I would move to defer it for 2 weeks so we can understand why the cost is going from $6,000 a month to $16,000 a month, and perhaps some explanation as to, other than it's just a sloppy process, as to why it's being put before us when it's going to expire next Monday. And until we put our foot down, this is going to continue and continue and continue. I saw 8 years of it under Governor O'Malley. I hate to see it happening again. So please, let's just give me the two. I'm not asking for the turn down of the contract. I'm just saying let's give it 2 weeks to understand exactly what did happen. I thought it was an excellent question to County Governor, because it doesn't make any sense what I just heard. And as a courtesy, I'd like to have 2 weeks to try to figure it out.
Yes, we have two motions.
I have two motions. I have no second. That is a motion to defer and a motion to approve, so I guess we can use that kind of a motion.
Madam Treasurer, what do you want to do?
I'm letting the board decide.
I'm prepared to, under these circumstances, to support the department. But
I mean, the Comptroller makes a very good point. I think we have put our foot down. Typically when I'm here, it seems that that happens a little more often. Let me ask, this is ongoing, but we have the, I think the Treasurer was seconding my motion, but I'll wait.
Here's
on
the first motion.
Right, I'll wait on that vote for a moment. 2 week delay, at least a 2 week delay, means that there's not training going on. Is this online training that pops up at a person's desktop and they go through it and review it? So,
yes, it is.
Are there people who are on Monday of next week, they're scheduled to do their training and they're not going to be trained?
The training is available on an ongoing basis. So if I receive the lesson for that month, I can take it at any time. So it is, training is taken throughout the month from beginning, middle, and end. So employees would lose access to training.
For a two-week period.
For at least a two-week period. And then I'm not sure of the tear-down and setup process either. So the lag could be longer.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to withdraw my motion. I'm going to second the Comptroller's motion and ask for a vote.
Okay.
Anyone in favor? Aye. Opposed?
What is the motion?
To defer for 2 weeks. Comes back to vote.
No.
Okay. 2-1. All right. Come back.
Thank you.
And now we still have item 1IT.
That's right. You threw everything out.
No, we did 2-4. No,
one more left.
One.
Didn't withdraw enough, apparently.
All right. Okay. We have a motion on the remainder, remaining item on the agenda.
Second.
Okay. All in favor? Okay. So one's approved.
Thank
the
you.
The others withdrawn. Thank you. Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Jim Ports, Deputy Secretary for Maryland Department of Transportation. Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 17 items today including three supplemental items. Item 8M has been revised.
I don't know if I have any questions or not. Actually. No. Let's start with 2AE, but I'm going to have similar with 3AE, to a lesser extent, some of the other AE contracts. As I mentioned before, I understand that some of the AE contracts, and these are on-call contracts, task order contracts.
Correct.
So, and for those who don't understand an on-call contract, it's where you award a contract at a maximum number that the department or the agency within can call the contractor or the group of contractors and say, I need you to do X, give me a price, go forward, up to a certain dollar amount. And so they tend to have this contract for many years. And while we call it on-call, contractors can actually market as well and say, hey, you have this contract vehicle. We can do this. So, but my concern is I see the same large engineering firms with the lockdown of these contracts. And so I just want to know if the department is and the agencies are looking to expand the pool of candidates and particularly looking at the smaller and the minority firms.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I would point...
As prime contractors and not just to get the...
That changes the question.
Dropping.
So, the answer would be yes. We are looking for opportunities for smaller firms. So I would just point to 8M and 9M. I know they're maintenance contracts, but they're going to small firms. One of those is a $4 million contract. So we are looking for those opportunities. But at the same time, as you mentioned, Lieutenant Governor, many of these services, we don't know what they're going to be until we know what they're going to be. And they get defined later, as you mentioned. And so what we look to do, and this is part of our plan, we have a very aggressive DBE, MBE goal structure. I noticed that 1AE is a 20% DBE, 2AE has a 27% DBE, and 3AE has a 35% DBE requirement. And so we are looking for those, and I think... let's see, on 3AE, I see Century Engineering, and, of course, they're using some of the other smaller firms also. So we are looking for those opportunities, and as we do that, we're hoping that they do get that education and that experience so that they, too, then can also bid as a prime contractor. So that is the goal.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not sitting here looking at the technical requirements because I know AE contracting is under the technical review before you negotiate a price, but, you know, in environmental design management and inspection, particularly a state highway, and state highway has been an issue for years in terms of how they do business, and particularly with the A&E firms. They actually got into a little trouble a couple of years ago in terms of some of these areas. And some of it was with some of these same contractors, too. That, you know, I'm not sure, and $5 million as an on-call contract, meaning that you're not going to get one $5 million task order. You get smaller task orders. Mm-hmm. There are environmental design firms out there that are smaller than the KCIs and JMT and Century. And believe me, I know a lot of the principals in these organizations.
Sure.
But, and they're great organizations, but they shouldn't get everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, or at least there should be some competition, even though A&E is different. It's an art, and so they don't really compete the same way some other industries do. So I'm sending a message out that I want, particularly State Highway, to do a better job of looking at these firms, and maybe Jimmy Reed can help you in terms of firms that are ready to be primes. I'm not saying take the guy with one truck. Mm-hmm. You know, and a pick. But, you know, there are firms out there that are ready to do prime work, and particularly in some of these areas like environmental engineering, that they can do it.
Okay.
So
we will take that back, and we absolutely look forward to your task force committee.
Okay.
Yes, revising a lot of our
right.
procurement
issues.
And
we want to talk about that as well, but definitely, and the message needs to go to State Highway.
Mm-hmm.
I know Cheryl Hill. You need to send that message to Cheryl Hill.
She's in the audience.
Right. Hiding in the back. Okay.
She is.
Okay. Yes.
She heard it.
Yeah. Send the message to Ms. Hill. And so we need that work to be done.
Okay.
Okay.
Done.
All right. Thank you.
Did you hear that, Cheryl? Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
We need
it. Yeah, if you're going to speak from
the microphone, please.
You want to come up?
Okay.
So, Deputy Director of Procurement for SHA.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon or good morning. I'm Georgia Peek, and I am the Deputy Director of the Office of Procurement at State Highway. And I just wanted to mention that we are already looking into that for small businesses, and we're anticipating putting environmental design, as you had just mentioned, and compliance, and also traffic services. And we're looking maybe at some survey and engineering, but we're not sure yet for that. Mm-hmm. But in the next probably 6 to 8 months, we should be putting out contracts that we're going to do possibly like 2 reduced candidate lists,
mm-hmm.
you know, within one procurement, so that we can have the small businesses come and, you know, bid against themselves or, you know, so that they're in competition with other small businesses rather than the large.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will award probably around $3 million contracts, give or take, depending on the size of the original one and the ones that we're going to give to the smalls. And that is already kind of in the works, and we're planning on doing that.
All right. Very good. I'll be watching.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sure. Word's already going out because you've mentioned this before, and, mm-hmm. and I did. I have to admit, I liked when you sat next to me over here better.
Better. Okay. I can sit, I think, anywhere. The governor might be anywhere. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
I just had a brief question on number 4, the 21-day shutdown of
yes.
Metro train service. So what are you doing to let people know about this? And I do see that there will be a bus bridge, which I assume a bus bridge is a bus going back and forth. Or
correct.
Just a little bit about the impact on people.
Yes. Yes, good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Jim Knighton, Chief of Staff at Maryland Transit Administration. Yes, a bus bridge is essentially a shuttle bus service that takes people to the various stops along the rail line when the rail is out of service. MTA has an Office of Customer and Community Relations that does extensive public notification and outreach, and this is a major shutdown, so we would have our folks out months ahead of time. We'd certainly do notification on our website. We would also go to nearby businesses and reach out to community associations and neighborhood associations in the vicinity of those stations, come to their meetings, distribute leaflets. And while the shutdown is going on, we have signage and what we call transit ambassadors
mm-hmm.
That direct people to the shuttle buses while it's going on. So we have a very well developed process for that.
What is the timing of this? The rollout of it?
We're looking at the summer of 2016. So it would be the end of July into the middle of August of 2016 for the actual 21-day shutdown.
And the bus bridge will essentially mimic the metro.
That's correct. Yes, there are two portions to it. There will be an express service that goes from our Mondawmin Transit Center in the city out to Milford Mill, which is the end of the portion of the line where the shutdown is. So there will be an express shuttle, and then there will be another shuttle that stops at all 5 stations that are affected
by
the shutdown.
And how frequently will they run?
We're going to set it up to so that it mimics fairly closely the running time of the metro subway itself. So it'll be about every 10 to 15 minutes. And that runs 5 a.m. to midnight. So.
As I assume the metro?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's how it runs. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. That's good.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
I just wanted to take advantage of Mr. No, that's fine. That's, I've got you. I just wanted to take advantage of Mr. Ports being here to ask a couple of questions about the administration's plan to close the Chester River Bridge this summer, which connects Chestertown with Queen Anne's County over on the Upper Eastern Shore for up to, I believe you're planning to close it for 4 weeks. I believe your pick, July 18th to August 12th for the painting and repairs. Obviously, I'm not saying anything that you and your team don't already know, but this area's economy is heavily dependent on summertime tourism, and closing a bridge right in the heart of the season is going to present an enormous burden for both visitors and small businesses. I've read the local media. I know that local tourism officials are, God bless them, they have optimism in their DNA. They're planning to make the best of a bad situation, and I respect them for it, but with all due respect for the things I've read about, river cruises, band concerts, and ferries going back and forth, and other creative ideas, the fact is that this is going to cut off Chestertown from the rest of the Eastern Shore and from a good portion of the Baltimore-Washington corridor at a time when many of these small businesses in Chestertown are already struggling. And they need those summer weekends to end up in the black. I know I'm coming in at the 11th hour, but and I'm obviously appreciate the work that SHA has done as far as communicating with the public stakeholders. But could you just help me with what is the SHA actually doing to the bridge, and why is it necessary to close the entire bridge rather than coming up with a way to perform the work through an overnight bridge closure or closing individual lanes of traffic?
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Comptroller. It's a great question. This is part of our bridge preservation program, and obviously it needs some painting. It's a movable bridge. And the quickest way to get it done is to raise the draw, if you will, and I guess break it down and then repaint it. SAJ originally had this advertised a year or so ago, and it was removed because of the very concerns that you're talking about today throughout the community and, of course, elected officials. From that, a special task force was created to discuss this project. And, of course, by the way, I want to say we also work with the Coast Guard on this because of the navigable waters. But the task force included county commissioners, various members of the business community, Washington College community members, District 2, and our Office of Structures. They met several times, and they came out with a few points. One is the task force agreed upon the following. Chester River should remain as a drawbridge. That was one of the compromises. The only way to properly paint the bridge, as I mentioned, was in the upright position, which would mean you'd have to temporarily close the bridge for about 4 weeks. The proper incentives and disincentives were set to ensure the bridge is open to traffic as soon as possible. And they agreed, believe it or not, that the best closure period was from July 18th to August 14th. And that was a task force made up of all those folks. So, as always, I mean, Governor Hogan and Lieutenant Governor Rutherford are, have an extremely strong customer focus, and we're always willing and more than happy to continue to work with local communities like this on our large infrastructure projects. But the question comes down, basically, do we disrupt traffic for a much longer period, usually about 2 years, and with that, there's safety concerns because of shifting lanes and such, and using people directing traffic, or do you, I guess, bite the bullet in a way and do it in 4 weeks, and this is what the task force had agreed to. So I understand media as well as you do, you know, and how that works. And not always do you get a good story, but this is what the task force agreed to.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Did they consider doing it earlier in the summer or late spring, such as kind of that mid-April to mid-May or late April to
Yes, and we're still open to that, quite frankly. If this task force, the elected officials, and all the other people, the business owners and all that, would like us to try and do it earlier or find a different time frame, we're more than happy to do that. Obviously, you can't do it in February or
right.
March.
Right.
Not when you're painting, but you know, the April, May, whatever. We're more than happy to work with the local community.
Although, as a former citizen of Chestertown reminds us, there is
and it's a college that happens to be there.
Well, and a major festival that you want to work around.
When is the festival? Not Memorial.
And maybe that's part of the reason why we didn't do Memorial Day, is because of that festival. So, I mean, yeah, there's a
lot.
I mean, there's pluses and minuses to all these infrastructure projects. We try to do the best we can to minimize the impact. And this is how it was agreed to.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Lieutenant Governor, for jumping in, because that actually was the question I was going to pose, which is, I remember you made some significant repairs on the Harry Kelly Bridge going into Ocean City last year, but you decided to keep certain lanes open. There was a backup, but people were still able to get over. And what I really liked about that proposal was that you did the work in March, which is a relatively quiet period down on the beach, and I assume is a relatively quiet period in Chestertown. And so if you could... Not sure what this task force, how exactly the idea that there could be a, rather than right in the heart of the summer, you could do it in March or October. My reading of the media is that you guys are very firm, maybe because of the task force. I didn't see any mention of the task force. All I saw was the SHA engineer said, this is the way it's going to be, period.
Right.
And sometimes when that's out there, you kind of yield and say, okay, I guess that's been decided. But if there is some flexibility, it could be done in March or October, I think you'd find a lot of small businesses, restaurants and others down there saying, gee, that's really good.
I'll go back to SHA and see what it will, have them again work with the task force or other people to see when the best time is. But
thank you.
Yeah, but again, we're more than happy to work with them.
Okay, it's worth taking a look, and I know
sure.
the college there as well, but there may be some leeway.
Exactly,
I mean, April's usually not that bad though. And, when does the college graduate? Do you know offhand?
May.
What, first Saturday or May? Second Saturday?
But then you have Memorial Day. And you have
well,
July,
before Memorial Day.
Yeah. So it gets, it's complex.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions
sure.
on the transportation agenda?
Move approval.
All in favor? Thank you. Department of General Services.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Gail Bassett, Secretary of General Services. The department has 18 items on our agenda. We are withdrawing item 7. I'm glad to answer any questions you may have.
Governor, could I just say for the record that item 15, which is a grant to the White Marsh Volunteer Fire Department, is not only a great grant, but has received the enthusiastic support of Senator Kathy Klausmeier.
Oh, good.
And Dr. Holder, I would tell you that, and thank you.
Thank you.
We have some of them in here.
That's Senator Sanders.
Yes.
She's probably in session.
She should.
But, White Marsh Fire, Volunteer Fire Company.
Who? If I could, I absolutely support myself, being a Perry Hall resident, and much of the services that we get is from the White Marsh or Cowington Fire Department. So they're an excellent group, and they're very, very, very active in the community. Great.
You probably do need a good fire company in your given your lifestyle.
Thank you for the governor.
No,
just wanted to.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to end on a
happy note, which is that folks in my part of the state are enjoying, right next door to us, the finest example of a professional hockey team in the history of the NHL, and that is the Washington Capitals, who are a born to sorrow team, I promise you. I have rooted for them for 38 years. And sometimes they're good during the regular season, and they don't, inevitably they fail in the playoffs. This year, through 58 games, which is two-thirds of the NHL schedule, they have won more games during that period than any team in the history of the NHL. And they are something special and unique. Even folks that don't understand hockey and think it's a brutalitarian sport and goes too fast, take an opportunity if you have and watch this team, because they are pretty unique. And Ted Leonsis, the owner, seriously has done the region an enormous favor by creating this extraordinary athletic program. So just wanted to tell you that Caps are going to win the Stanley Cup. Rock the red.
All right. Keep hope alive. No, I'm rooting for them, too. We've seen in the playoffs.
We'll keep a little faith. But this is what the Lieutenant Governor just mentioned is so common among Caps fans. And all I can say is this year there's really something going on. So thank you very much.
Okay. Before we close, I just want to commend item 18, the CGL capital grant and loan to Tarek House. They do wonderful work in Baltimore with some of those who are suffering from substance abuse. Is there a representative here today, by any chance? Okay. Not to hold up too much longer, but this very last item on the very last agenda.
Good morning. My name is Ahmad Alad. I'm the administrator of Office of Capital Planning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I have Mr. Kevin Taylor, who is the CEO of Tarek House, here with us.
Tell us just briefly about the Tarek House.
Okay. The Tarek House is a... I am Kevin Tyler. I'm the executive director of Tarek House. Tarek House has been performing in Baltimore for over 45 years. Tarek House looks to transform individuals, families, and communities by providing substance use services. We've been doing it, again, for over 45 years in the Baltimore area. Tarek House has developed a brand that's well-known in West Baltimore. Mm-hmm. We serve right near the area where we had the uprising during the Freddie Gray incident. And it's very important that we continue those services and either even expand them as the opiate and heroin epidemic continues to grow, not only in Baltimore but in the surrounding areas.
Well, thank you, and keep up the good work, and hopefully this grant will help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions on DGS agenda? Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We all are. Thank you. Thank you. Everyone have a wonderful day.
Same to you.
All right, Dale.
All right.
We've got one of our good ones.
Oh, you already got one.
From Junior Walker and the All-Stars. That's how sweet it is, right here on WNAV Radio. Hey, coming up this afternoon at 2, Rick Franke's in the studio with guests for the WNAV Boat Show. Boating season not too far down the road. Join them right here or online at 1430WNAV.com. Our weather is stormy today, but improving in